Resonance Rewind.
Be kind. Resonance Rewind.
Roger Moore is James Bond, 007, in Ian Fleming's Live and Let Die.
My name's Bond. James Bond.
Names is for tombstones, baby. Waste him, now.
James Bond is back, and wherever he drops in, it can mean only one thing.
Trouble!
This is the Bond adventure with more excitement, more action, more danger, and more. Much more. Roger Moore as James Bond, 007. Seven is on a worldwide manhunt. The body count is going up. And where Bond stops to visit, he leaves his mark on everything.
They'll kill you.
They will kill us. Love is lesson number two. Togetherness.
Is there time before we leave for lesson number three?
Absolutely.
Your seat and hang on.
If any man can show just cause where they might not lawfully be joined together.
Because Bond is on the move. And if you miss this one, you'll miss the most exciting 007 adventure of them all.
Barnsley, licensed to legally do all manner of wonderful things at the University of Lincoln, make of Live and Let Die, with, of course, such blaxploitation themes and quips and merry jibes, etc. Ian, your thoughts, please.
I thoroughly enjoyed Live and Let Die. It's one of my favourite Bond films. It came out just before I was born, actually, funnily enough. And I always, you know, Bond films are on every summer on ITV. I always watch them over and over again. And I always see something new that I hadn't seen before. And there's no difference with this one. I must have seen it about six or seven times, and I keep finding things that I've never seen before in it. And I found it, again, a really good film. Good characters in it. Bond's very good in it. He's just at his right age. In this one, he's not too young, he's not too old, he's at his highest strength as James Bond in this one, I think.
Interesting, because I enjoyed it certainly first time round. I did actually see it in the cinema as a youngster. It was my second Bond movie, because the first one I ever saw was Diamonds Are Forever, and clearly also directed by Guy Hamilton. But very much at the hind end of the Sean Connery era. Here we have a new Bond. We have something which had only happened once before in the series, with George Lazenby, of course, coming in with Her Majesty's Secret Service. It was obviously going to happen again with Timothy Dalton, with Pierce Brosnan, and, of course, with Daniel Craig. And it's interesting that they went back to Guy Hamilton as a director who they had faith in, because he delivered Goldfinger, of course, for them, and it certainly had an edge for that. And Roger Moore, of course, having had that TV series with Tony Curtis as Danny Wilde, of course, The Persuaders, we looked at it last time on Resonance Rewind, This was a much harder edge to Moore. And I think a lot of people say that the sequence where he's having the love scene with the CIA double agent, of course, played by Gloria, in terms of the sequence there, is something which they could never imagine Simon Templar actually doing. They could certainly never imagine Brett Sinclair doing it, but they could have actually resonated with Ian Fleming's Sean Connery incarnation, doing that with Gloria Hendry, of course, playing Rosie Carver. Because it's one of those things where for the first time you actually see a hard edge to Moore, which I think he really brought out in this movie. I mean, did you feel that he managed to encompass the role of James Bond effectively? Because the first time we see him, of course, after the opening credits, is with Madeline Smith, who, of course, has done several of these shows back in the day, as, of course, the Italian agent Miss Caruso.
Well, he's a very different James Bond to Sean Connery. But then I guess every time they've had a new James Bond, they've changed the way the outlook of Bond to a certain extent. But at the end of the day, he's a secret agent. He's a spy. He's licensed to kill. So he's got to be quite sinister in what he does in a lot of ways. Even though with Bond, there are more of the quips with Roger Moore than there were perhaps with Sean Connery. And it's a little bit more tongue in cheek at times, but at the end of the day, it's a spy movie. And he can turn from laughing, jokey James Bond, if you can call it that, to something a little bit more serious. And when he needs to take people out, he can do that.
There were some moments of genuine threat I felt in this movie, one of which I've just popped up on the screen behind me in terms of the interrogation with Mr. Big, of course, the alter ego of the main villain, Dr. Kananga, and the threatening of having his little finger snipped and so on. Yaphet Kotto wasn't known for his role in Alien, because that would be a movie a few years down the line at this particular point. But I did feel he actually, again, gave a gravitas to the role of Bond villain, a Bond villain not only as a character who, according to Ian Fleming in the original novel, had connections with the KGB and Smersh, etc., but here is very much seen as a drug villain, an overlord, and somebody who was very much looking to impact on organized crime. And reading, in fact, Roger Moore's autobiography of the movie, which is the 007 Diaries, Moore actually raises just the issue of how dangerous it was for a white film crew in 1970s America to be filming in Harlem. They'd already had threats of not watching the movie from various parts of Middle America because Bond dared to have a romance with Rosie Carver, i.e. a non-white leading lady. I mean, it's interesting when we look at that. I mean, sometimes now from the 21st century perspective, we find it difficult to appreciate how it could ever have been like that. Do you feel there's any danger that this movie could be cancelled as a result of the fact that, whoa, where are we going here? You know, there are lots of racial stereotypes, including actually Sheriff J.W. Pepper, who, if anything, actually epitomizes the worst stereotype of redneck Americana.
Yeah, there are certainly a lot of things in here that make you go, oh, said he on. But, you know, the film is of its time, I would say. I mean, it hasn't been cancelled yet. Whether it could be one day, I don't know. But then you could cancel quite a few James Bond films in that way, and many, many films in other than James Bond as well, because, you know, it is of its time. And I certainly did, you know, make note of some of the references that Bond made and some of the other characters were making of him being in Harlem and going into that cafe. It was very strong at the time. I'm sure it's even stronger now.
Oh. Okay, let's talk about one of the, I think, in essence, interesting characters, that Jane Seymour, of course, who is known in some instances not only as being married to Michael Attenborough, of course, the son of Richard Attenborough. Of course, Jane Seymour would subsequently divorce, but there'd be all sorts of other issues there, which I know I had lots of interesting comments on from Charlotte Attenborough when she spoke to me about it a few years ago. But Jane Seymour actually has her voice dubbed throughout this entirety of the movie by Nikki Van Zyl, which I thought was, again, interesting. She seems to kind of go on a pathway from being a fairly together, focused visionary and seer and soothsayer to being a classic damsel of, in distress in a fairly sort of short period of time. Admittedly, she had had the experience of the double decapitation, well, at least single decapitation in terms of vehicles, because we had the decapitation of the London double-decker bus, and we also had the decapitation of the aircraft, which obviously lost its wings as well. So clearly slicing heads off was a subtle thing that they'd woven into this. How do you feel Jane Seymour actually comes across? I mean, I don't think for me she really could be marked out as a solid Bond leading lady.
She's not your archetypal blonde Bond woman, Bond girl. But what I would say is she kind of floats from being very timid to quite sinister in her own way a little bit when it comes to the cards and the tarot and all that kind of imagery that is there. So I think there's two sides to, I mean, Jane Seymour is an absolute beauty, and I think she does fit into the annals of Bond girls, and you know, she's got her place within that. And just because it's such an unusual Bond film anyway, with the voodoo and the tarot reading and everything, there isn't really another Bond film with that kind of content. But I think she has a place in the film, and I do think she has that two sides to her. She has the timid side, and she is very vulnerable in certain situations. But actually, she has got a turn of phrase to her, and she's quite strong in what she's doing as well, even though she's got Kananga, sinister Kananga in her behind her.
There's one sequence where effectively they're at the airport, and Solitaire, the character, comes up with, "My only regret is I won't be there to see it." And she pretends to whack Bond over the head with a handbag. I wasn't quite sure how that kind of really fitted into the whole, because there was no indication that they'd actually set up a kind of way to create a distraction, or whether that was just a case of thinking on the spot, really, like so much of the Bond movies can be.
Well, there's two possibilities here. It could have been something that they planned. I mean, I noted that as well when she said that. I thought that was a bit out of character considering what we'd seen previously. Yeah. It could have been planned. It could have been another side to her. Maybe she's playing Bond at that point.
Somebody who certainly does play it is the character that you have up on your screen behind you, which is Jeffrey Holder, of course, who did all the choreography for this particular movie. And impressive it certainly is. But there's probably more ambiguity about the ending in this than had been the case for many of the earlier Bond movies, because we're never sure whether actually the character of Baron Samedi actually is there. He continues to exist and therefore is Lord of the Undead.
Absolutely. When he appears on the train, the front of the train at the end, I just think that's the nature of the film. It's the voodoo. It's the magic side of it. He's keeping you, you know, it's making you aware that there is undercurrents here. There is magic happening. There is voodoo happening here. And yes, he may well have ended. I think he ended up in the snakes, didn't he? He ended up face first in a load of snakes in the coffin, I think. You know, that might not have been his end. I suspect it was, but then, you know, it gets across that this is the only James Bond that has ever done that, really, you know, somebody who has returned from the dead, so to speak. But
yeah, I mean, there was a tendency, certainly with the character of Richard Keel as Jaws, to kind of come back for another bite, so we say. But this was the first time I think they deliberately left that thing open. Talking about deliberately being left open, let's talk a bit about Roger Moore's officially sanctioned favourite character or favourite actor on the whole movie. Not David Hedison, who I think he was a good friend of in any case. And I was particularly impressed with David Hedison's role of Felix Leiter, something which he would actually resume in the License to Kill episode with Timothy Dalton. Later on, where we have the immortal line which Ian Fleming had used originally in this novel, when Leiter is fed to the sharks and has the pin put on him, basically, or the sign he disagreed with something that ate him. But Roger Moore's favourite actor, apparently, according again to his autobiography, was Julius Harris as Teehee. So any thoughts about your own favourite character? Or are you going to say, well, even though she was only in it for a short period of time, we've got to give it to Lois Maxwell as much money, Penny? Because after all, she actually stopped James Bond from being hauled over the call for his Italian romances.
For me, I mean, Teehee does fit into that. He makes a good henchman. For me, I don't think Holder is a henchman as such. Teehee is the henchman, and he's got the gimmick with the arm. He does fit into it. He doesn't have an awful lot to do in the film, not as much as Jaws would have done or Oddjob. But he certainly plays his part in the role. I mean, Holder's my, you know, Baron Samedi's my favourite character in the film. He really does make Live and Let Die for me.
No mention of Clifton James and Sheriff Pepper, who, of course, would come back in The Man with the Golden Gun. I think an ongoing side of things there. And I think arguably you also saw a kind of similar character in the Las Vegas branch that was personified in Diamonds Are Forever, or put forward there. We talked about the ending of the movie. It's probably worthwhile noting the music, which took a completely distinctly different tone here by featuring, of course, Beatle Paul McCartney and his band Wings in a version. Well, basically, they originated Live and Let Die, despite, I think, Guns N' Roses doing a fairly solid rendition of it in later years. Or was it John Bon Jovi? One of the two, or maybe both. This is an epic soundtrack, of course, with George Martin produced as well. You've got the John Barry classic Bond theme, but what did you make of Live and Let Die, the music?
It's the best Bond theme, in my opinion, throughout all of them. It's the most powerful. And I do like, I mean, when I listen to Live and Let Die, either it's Guns N' Roses version or Paul McCartney's, I think about all the different themes within it, that because various different parts of that song are played throughout the film at various different points, you know, points of danger, points of excitement. You can hear that through the entire song. I mean, I've listened to that song, you know, many, many times when it's not being shown on, you know, on the film. It's not being with the film at the same time. And it just reminds me of all those bits and pieces within the film when I listen to it. It's a brilliant, brilliant piece of music.
Okay, so let's go for a feature that Victoria Simmons was keen to introduce, and we've used it in relatively recent episodes of Resonance Rewind. Favorite moment of the picture? If it helps, my favorite moment, curiously, is actually in the opening credit series, where we have the line, "Whose funeral is it?" to which the response is, "Yours," and then the complete takeover of the New Orleans Mardi Gras funeral, etc. But Ian, one for yourself.
I've got one brilliant piece and one very poor piece that I just want to highlight. I mean, I do like the New Orleans, the Mardi Gras, and the funeral procession. It just makes me think, if I ever go to New Orleans and I see one of those, run, basically, because you're going to get it. But what I would say, I mean, I've always remembered the crocodile scene, walking across the crocodiles, and I know it's ridiculous, but when I was younger, I would have said, there's no way they would have lined like that. That's ridiculous. It's not going to happen. Alligators, crocodiles, whichever they are, though he does mention both in it. But then I think it's Hollywood. So what? It just makes it for a good story.
And of course, the crocodiles were trained by Ross Kananga, who effectively was a farmer of crocodiles in Jamaica, where they obviously shot that particular sequence, even though it was set supposedly in the Louisiana swamps and so on. And Kananga, of course, therefore lent his name to the main villain of the piece as well. So yeah, it certainly was an interesting line of things there. And you know, those crocodiles were real in many ways. So we got, that's something which, again, I think a lot of the stunts that you saw here, the huge motorboat sequence, the chase around that side of things there, there was a sense there that actually, yes, in these days of let's put it all on CGI, there was a sense of genuine Hollywood about this, which was very much the circus of Bond.
And lots of gimmicks and lots of strange, you know, booths turning and, you know, tables disappearing into the ground and all that kind of stuff. The gimmicks were not really the spy gimmicks. They were the villains' gimmicks, weren't they, in this one, rather than Q's toys that, you know, with the watch and all that.
Well, exactly. And I suppose the major issue that some Bond aficionados still have with the movie was, of course, the exploding Mr. Big, Dr. Kananga, at the end with the compressed air gas pellet Of course, Whisper, played by Earl Jolly Brown, I think might still have been around because I think he just had to suffer the misfortune of having the sofa he was sitting on explode. I think he might still have actually been there. Again, who knows, maybe sort of tying into to another line as well. Okay, little mention as well for Roy Stewart as Quarrel. Let's go to the number before the rest of the team actually join us for this particular episode of Resonance Rewind. What are you going to score 007?
That'll be an 8 from me.
Thank you.
Okay, so those are the thoughts of Ian Barnsley, plus some of the music of the New York Experience, as composed by George Martin, of course, the man who very much was behind the Beatles. But let's find out what our other members of the Residents Rewind team make of Bond's eighth outing, starting off with Jessica Burtis in North Carolina. Jessica, you're closest to New Orleans in terms of the Deep South and so on. You may well have taken part in some of those motorboat chases, perhaps. But what are your thoughts on the text?
So I hadn't seen this before. I just knew the Beatles song, which kept just playing in my head over and over. Or the Live and Let Die one. But I actually, I don't recall watching a ton of Roger Moore as James Bond. So it was nice getting to see him playing Bond. I think that this one had some interesting ideas, with the whole, like Mr. Big is actually Kananga, and there's the voodoo thing happening, and it's like all over the US. I thought that was interesting, and I was actually really curious about how, because apparently this one is based off of one of the original James Bond novels. So I was really curious about how the novel compared to how the movie adaptation was made. But I think this one was it was actually really funny, because there were just so many hilarious scenes in this movie, like the wingless plane driving by a window and the cop who's like, whose side is this man a secret agent for, because he's just wreaking havoc. I think that this movie was actually really funny, more than most James Bond movies, so I admired that. I never vibe with James Bond himself. I just, he's a And in the older movies, I think it just goes without saying, you know, how he is. But I thought it was actually fun. The deaths were a little convoluted. I think having a man inflate himself to death was one of the weirdest Hollywood deaths I have ever seen. But it was still entertaining.
Yeah, lots of interesting aspects there, including, as you mentioned, the East Coast of America, because it's very much New York to New Orleans. And then, of course, the island run by Mr. Big that we see developed. The original novel, of course, was the second in the series that Ian Fleming actually wrote. And a lot of the aspects kind of were reworked for License to Kill later on in the series with Timothy Dalton. But again, in terms of the actual narrative itself, this was a bit of a gamble, because it was the first movie post Sean Connery and Diamonds Are Forever. Obviously, there had been an earlier attempt at Bond played by George Lazenby, which we looked at with On Her Majesty's Secret Service. But George Lazenby had given up the role after just the one movie. And of course, Roger Moore, totally different from what we saw him in last week. As far as Brett Sinclair and The Persuaders is concerned, you can't imagine Brett Sinclair being quite as lethal with respect to his leading ladies as Bond obviously was. Victoria, was it your first time seeing this particular movie, or were you just familiar with the Guns N' Roses version of Wings title number Live and Let Die?
No, I didn't think that I'd seen it before. And then there was little elements of it, the voodoo dolls with the rifles in them. Well, not rifles, but the guns in them. And those little bits, I say, I'm sure at some point I must have seen this, but I've now only got halfway through rewatching, well, two thirds of the way rewatching it. But I think I'm pretty sure I've seen it.
So you've yet to come across the inflatable death of Mr. Big, a.k.a. Kananga. Mm. I think the henchmen, of course, that we see here, Julius Harris, as we've talked about in terms of Teehee, very much Roger Moore's favourite co-star for this particular side of things. And, of course, we had Whisper, who I think still survived to tell the tale. But there is that playing around, as we said. Baron Samedi, of course, is he alive? Is he there? He sort of emerges in all sorts of ways. And of course, the characters of Solitaire personification of Dr. Kananga as well. Kananga, indeed named after Ross Kananga, the real life owner of the crocodile farm. Any particular favorite moments, Jessica, from the text, which you thought, I quite enjoyed that?
I mean, I think that the motorboat chase was pretty fun, especially because like the waterways are such a big part of New Orleans and Louisiana. So I thought that was pretty fun, very dramatic. I feel like there's always a James Bond scene with him in a speedboat, but I like it. It's just fun, you know. I want to drive a speedboat that fast. So I thought that was really cool. I think that the crocodile scene with the deaths was very interesting, because in the array of animals they used to kill James Bond instead of a gun, I think that the crocodiles were a fun one because I would actually be afraid of the crocodiles. The sharks aren't so scary, but I think it is like it's normal in the South for there to be signs on like rivers and stuff that are like, oh, don't go swimming, there's crocodiles. So they're actually really scary. But he just ran across them. Like, I don't know if that would fly with like the animal associations today. But I thought that was like one of the more like I thought that that death scene was kind of that trap. It was perfect for the setting. I thought it was great. And I also just like any scene that the cop is in or the sheriff. He is so funny and goofy, and he's just adorable. I just thought that he was like great because I feel like he just vocalizes the things everybody's thinking in these scenes where it's just like, who is this man? But I think it actually had quite a lot of good scenes.
Clifton James, of course, portrays Sheriff Pepper, and he'd go on to reprise that role in the subsequent follow-up to this, The Man with the Golden Gun, although not in Louisiana that time, would be over in the Far East. It could be said that Clifton James also, with Sheriff Pepper, epitomizes the classic redneck stereotype of white American elderly male or middle American male, and basically who has a fairly sort of interesting perspective on life, I think. I was going to say racist, but I think it's in all sorts of ways. You've got a lot of issues that come across there in terms of obviously the relevance to the kind of novel, which we never see made explicit here, about the Black Russians that are raising hell in Florida. In the original book, Kananga was actually employed by the KGB, and there was a more explicit relationship with obviously the Russians, the Soviet Union, as opposed to just a drug cartel and issues relating to that. Victoria, your favourite moments?
I actually really like, have to put a mention out to whoever designed the costume for Solitaire when she's sitting and it's like on the regal chair and it's almost something that you go into as a cover, not an actual outfit. But I have to mention that is amazing. Whoever designed that had a lot of imagination. But if I actually like it, maybe it's the music. When they do the funerals in New Orleans and it's all really sad, and then they turn a corner and it's big party. And when I was in New Orleans and I went round the French Quarter, I can just imagine that happening. And I really enjoyed that.
Yeah, the costume design was by Julie Harris, as far as the actual text was concerned, and Sid Kane was production designer. But you're right, it was actually one of my stated favourite moments, certainly the opening teaser trailer, which for a change doesn't feature any James Bond whatsoever. You just have the three sequences. First of all, the United Nations burning out of the man's sort of hearing, and death by that side of things. And then, of course, the whose death is whose funeral is it anyway? To which the response is yours, and the chap comes to a sticky end. And we're never quite sure whether Strutter has the same experience when it's almost a reprise of that whole sequence. But maybe he does, maybe he doesn't. He certainly doesn't seem to appear in the rest of the movie. So we're presuming that Strutter, the CIA agent, also comes to a sticky end from that point of view. Okay, let's talk about characters. I mean, we talked, Jessica, about the aircraft scene and the airport scene. Will Mrs. Bell receive one for yourself in terms of the way she was taking her driving lessons, her flying lessons, and of course Ruth Kempf, the actress, in a state of shock? Or would it actually be the owner of the aircraft who comes to deal with obviously losing his plane. The second decapitation, as you said, I mean, you've got planes losing their wings. You've got a London double-decker bus that loses its roof. You've got a whole range of issues that are here. But what is your favourite character from that line?
I think, well, I have a couple honourable mentions. Sheriff Pepper, of course, because like you said, unfortunately, in the US, there's quite a lot of classism against like Southern people, and especially in film portrayals, they're often just bumbling idiots. But I think that he just pointed out like what nobody else did, that James Bond is just wreaking havoc everywhere he goes. I'm like, yes, this man is just driving boats around houses and just playing, you know, he does number. But I think that he was great. And I really like Jane. I think she was kind of, you know, treated in the typical James Bond womanizer kind of way. But I thought her character was really interesting in that she was like a tarot reader, associated with the villains. And I feel like she just had like a very ethereal quality about her that suited the New Orleans setting. But my favorite character is the snake from the bathroom scene that tries to kill James Bond. He was great. He did excellent work. I loved his role. I thought that he was a very talented actor. I think it was a fake snake at the end when he killed it. So like hoping it was fake, but I thought the snake he was great. Favorite character.
Yes, and not necessarily something you would want to try by using aerosol can lit by or ignited by a cigar to actually burn a snake alive, really. I wouldn't try it or recommend it in any way, shape or form. But yeah, that was an interesting line. And of course, following on from that, we have the emergence of the double agent, the CIA operative, of course, Rosie Carver, who effectively, again, goes through her own short-lived narrative arc from being a sort of bumbling CIA operative to being an operative for Mr. Big to obviously coming to a sticky end when she actually has that choice and is told by Bond to actually make the choice where she's going to go. I was curious, though, a slight sort of plot hitch. I wasn't sure, did they only have one bullet per Scarecrow? Because surely Bond was also in the same target area when Rosie was hit as well. And I was surprised there didn't seem to be a second attempt to say, oh, well, we've got the girl by mistake, but here's Bond, we'll shoot him now. It's just a thought. Victoria, what about characters for yourself? Are you going to go down the line of the snake? Will it be the hat worn by a small person who lost a fight with a chicken? Or would it be something more unusual?
I have a few honourable mentions. I liked the witch doctor dancer at the hotel. I thought he did a wonderful job.
And did Jeffrey Holter, the actor, also was the choreographer for all of those events as well.
And, well, I mean, Solitaire, I really like Jane Seymour in that. And for some reason, I actually like the taxi driver that sort of ends up keep picking him up and taking him back to Mr. Big. And I'm just like, how did they not see it's him? But, you know.
I mean, I think but Bond certainly did recognise that it was the same driver who had led him to the Harlem base in the first sort of sequence. But of course, it was too late, and the divide went up, and he was left there to actually deal with the sort of the delivery sort of package from that point of view. But yeah, I mean, again, interesting in terms of that, because I gather from the original autobiography Roger Moore put together for this that the race tensions in Harlem at the time were particularly high, and in fact the film Clue itself, because this was at the height of, as far as movies were concerned, the blaxploitation element of cinema and so on, there were issues in which actually the crew's safety was to a certain extent at risk, really. Not, of course, you can't say it wasn't at risk when they were dealing with all the stunts and the planning that Guy Hamilton had actually put into place as well. Okay, so allowing for all of that then, and you know, we see how it sort of operated and so on, this was indeed the eighth official Bond movie that was actually made. It would go on to form part of a long-running Roger Moore series, because he would go on to do another five, I think, in addition to these. What are you going to score it for as far as the opening in the era of Roger Moore, James Bond, is concerned, Jessica?
You know, I think falling off the like the how do I say it? Like coming off of such an iconic James Bond, I think that this is still interesting James Bond movie. I don't think it's at like the caliber of some of the best, but I do think that it's an interesting one, and I think it has a lot of great imagery. I think that the way it was shot was actually very well done. I like the cinematography in it. The music's great. So I think this one actually has quite a bit to offer. So I'd give it a 7. I think it's worth a rewatch. Not one of the best, but also not bad, in my opinion. It's just dramatic and like maniacal enough to make it fun.
I mean, Yaphet Kotto, who we mentioned as the villainous Dr. Kananga, and so they took the name Kananga from the crocodile farmer Ross Kananga. In real life, and decided to award that as the villain's main name. I think he went through various sinister areas. I mean, this was before Yaphet Kotto would appear, of course, in Alien and become a key Black African-American actor with a whole variety of areas. And he also commented in the extras about how the notion of time and space being all one, and this predicting the future. I mean, this is one of those rare Bond movies where, I mean, it's a spy movie. We go down the line of a major spy movie next week, which also focuses on brainwashing and so on. But in this particular instance, you've got the whole notion of belief and belief systems. And is tarot something which is a way of predicting the future? Obviously, Solitaire would say yes, and she loses the power because she's compelled to earthly love and so on. Bond himself has stacked the cards against his whole thing. Again, one of the issues which I probably had a minor challenge with was when we see Roger Moore hang gliding. And I'm not sure how, no matter how comfortable you could be as a hang glider, whether you'd actually be smoking a cigar whilst you're hang gliding, I would have thought is probably not necessarily the best way forward. I mean, it's just a thought. Maybe full concentration isn't given on the role there, but perhaps that's part of the whole thing. Victoria, what about yourself and numbers?
Yeah, with the hang gliding, I mean, how was he wearing like 3-4 layers of clothing as well whilst he was doing that? Although I did like the striptease trousers that came off when he gets off the glider and just stands there going, yeah, these come off and these come off, and I've still got this really sharp suit on.
Again, I wasn't quite clear in terms of why he switched from a sort of black outfit and ensemble, which seemed to be perfectly acceptable, to a reverse pattern in white. I mean, obviously, go to the safari suit element, but it seemed to quite sort of connect on that basis. But still, a bit like the equivalent in the opening sequence, which I believe was the last sequence to be filmed with the Italian agent Caruso, Miss Caruso, where in order to actually apparently get the cinematic magic of sheer magnetism, there was apparently one member of the cast had to actually be under Maddie Smith's dress to actually pull it down on a piece of string, because the magnetism obviously wasn't there in any way, shape, or form. There were about 4 or 5 people that are sort of out of that particular sequence. And also, you do have, of course, that wonderful scene with M, played by the late Bernard Lee, about how to actually cope with a coffee machine. And of course, the gadgets, which we don't see Q in this particular aspect. And even Miss Moneypenny has a very, very minor role in this. But anyway, Victoria, enough of those little ramblings. What are you going to score this at?
So far, I'm going to go with a 6. Now, this is, of course, because I'm rewatching and I'm still only half, 2/3 of the way through. If it, at this point, I've still got lots of, I think, elements that will tie up at the end, because I remember them all tying them up, but I just can't remember what happens. So it will probably come up to a 7 like Jessica, but at the moment I'm sort of still leading in. And there are some elements of it as well that I'm sort of just like, okay, that's Bond, but yeah, I'm not entirely sure about this bit.
Interesting. Again, I think certainly setting the scene for a variety of other things. And the penultimate movie that was co-produced by Harry Saltzman before he decided that, no, after Man with the Golden Gun, it was time to actually sell his shares in the company because it didn't have much longevity. Obviously, Cubby Broccoli actually maintained it and maybe arguably had the right decision in terms of sticking with Bond because this was back in 1973. And of course, there are the three-letter word Die would feature in No Time to Die, the most recent Bond, and of course Die Another Day, which was the last one in the Pierce Brosnan era. But next week, as we mentioned, and we seem to have scored around about 8, 7, 6 from that side of things for Live and Let Die, we still stick with Harry Saltzman on his own as a producer, but with a good friend of Roger Moore's, Michael Caine, otherwise known, of course, as Maurice Micklewhite, who portrays his own version of a super spy, Harry Palmer, who's short-sighted and has to undergo all sorts of challenges with respect to his time with the civil service and, of course, the spy organisation. Many people would say this is the real spy scenario that we're going to look at. Phil Hurdwood will probably be joining us, probably with some Michael Caine impersonations as well. But it will be the Len Data novel, The Ipcress File, as indeed produced by Harry Saltzman. Next up on Residence Rewind. For now, though, to Victoria Simmons, to Jessica Burtis, and earlier to Ian Barnsley, huge thanks. And I think we'll just go around the bayou with some suitable music to actually deal with crashing into weddings, crashing into people's locales, and generally dealing with crocodiles as well before we finish with Paul McCartney and Wings. Until then, of course, keep on resonating. We'll be right back.
When you were young and your heart was an open book, you used to say, live and let live.
You know you did, you know you did, you know you did.
But if this ever-changing world in which we live in makes you give in and cry, say, live and let die. Live and let die.